The idea then just to is that the connection here between avijja, yeah, ignorance, and then the choices that we make depend on that ignorance, and then our consciousness then again is dependent on that, and then as we start reducing the ignorance, yeah, reducing the delusion, then our choices change, and because our choices change, our consciousness is affected by the change in choices. The choices become more wholesome, they become better. And one of the kind of important points to make here is, how does that ignorance become less? Why is it that ignorance becomes less and more? And part of the answer is, or actually the whole answer really is, the teachings of the Buddha. Yeah, that's the thing that we saw yesterday. I don't know if you can remember now that sutta where we start off, what is the root cause of ignorance or avijja? And we said the immediate condition for avijja is the five hindrances. Yeah, and then we took it back all the way back to seeing the sapurisa, seeing the superior people. Yeah, what was the word used there? The good people, I think. Seeing the good people. So in other words, seeing the Buddha, seeing someone who has understood these teachings. So the answer is, if you want to reduce avijja, you have to keep on coming back to these teachings. Yeah, this is how you clarify that view. This is how you start to see the world in a new way. Almost all the things that I refer to in here are actually teachings found in the suttas. I should probably have done as Banda Sujata suggested, to actually just go straight to the sutta and get the sutta up there. But because I already had the slides kind of prepared, I'm just using them as they are, with a few refinements. But anyway, so this is where it comes from. And as you do that, as you gradually, your view of the world changes because you read in the suttas, then this process happens, yeah? You start to prioritize things in a different way. You have new values. The values gives rise to new priorities. And when you have new priorities, it is like your life takes a new course. It heads a new direction. You have different aims, different goals for what your life is all about. So this is what is happening here. But this goes one step further. Yeah, I've taken it one step further here. There comes a point when you see everything as impermanent. You don't see anything as permanent anymore. And this is the arising of avijja, which is the opposite of the avijja. So this is like the knowledge, yeah, or the insight into the nature of things. And the first thing that happens when you do that is you stop chasing after the worldly things, yeah? Why is that? Because you realize that the things of the world are utterly out of control. They're not really worthy of being chased after. Instead of chasing after those things, you kind of you go for the spiritual life 100%, yeah? And when you stop chasing the after the worldly things, what happens then? Well, that's when meditation really becomes powerful. Because this is exactly what blocks your ability to meditate, is the chasing after the worldly things. Yeah, so then your mind moves to the inner qualities instead. The external things are no longer of interest. And if the external world is no longer of interest, then the mind turns within quite easily. Yeah? So here, the sankharas make a big shift, yeah, away from the worldly things. But there's a deeper level. Yeah, there's a deeper way. And this is when you see the entire five khandhas as they really are, the entire five khandhas as impermanent, not only the external world, but both the external and the internal world. And when you see all of that as impermanent, as problematic, this is all the factors of personality, then what happens? You stop chasing after anything. The whole idea of chasing after things becomes silly. There's nothing to be chased after. It is all problematic. It all changes. There's nothing you can hold on to. And the entire idea of chasing actually starts to seem silly. So that at that point, when you see that, well, then sankharas come to an end because of that. Yeah, and sankharas don't serve any function anymore, because there's nothing in that world really worth having. On top, not only is there nothing really worth having, but on top of that, you realize that the very fact of chasing after things is painful. Yeah, like we chase after things in the world. They're always kind of looking after things. They're often trying to get hold of things. All that pursuit has a certain pain in it. Yeah, they're always the kind of, we have to move. It's like a restlessness, an agitation of the mind. And if you know a little bit about meditation practice, you know that one of the great benefits of meditation is precisely the calming down of the mind. Yeah, the chasing after things, the restlessness of the mind, is a pain. It is a problem. Yeah, the more you meditation you do, the more obvious that becomes. And so not only does it serve no function, but sankharas are also inherently painful. It's a double whammy. Yeah, so then when you do this, you find happiness and stillness instead. And this happiness and the stillness is the exact opposite of sankharas. Yeah, you let the sankharas go, stillness is where you find your happiness. One of the reasons why this is hard to see is because we identify with the sankharas. We take the sankharas to be who we are. And as long as we identify with sankharas, it is hard to see stillness as happiness, because we want to express our sense of self, and we express that through agency. And this is why there's usually a very close relationship between craving and our sense of self. And these are often very, very much related to each other. And that's why it is hard to see. But the more you kind of uncover this whole thing, the more clear this becomes. So then you stop making kamma, yeah, because you find happiness in stillness. You don't want to make any kamma anymore. You just, mind goes to stillness all the time. And then when you make no kamma at all, then you're not seeking for any happiness in the future. You're not seeking for happiness in the stillness in the here and now. You're no longer interested in the future. There's nothing of interest in the future. The five khandhas are seen as problematic. No need to get reborn. When you seek no happiness in the future, then consciousness is no longer inclined to the future. And it is this lack of inclination of the consciousness which makes it stop. Yeah, it is when the consciousness inclines toward something. In other words, consciousness and craving coming together, where consciousness is kind of looking towards some kind of future result. Yeah, if you want to be reborn, it means that your consciousness is inclining towards a rebirth. If you're looking towards a certain state of happiness, your consciousness is inclining towards that state of happiness. Yeah, and because of that inclination of the consciousness, that is then where the consciousness then continues because of that. It's like it's projecting itself into the future, just like craving is always about the future. So that is the rough outline of how this works. Yeah? How you, on the one hand, you create consciousness in a certain way, a certain level of consciousness, then the rebirth, and then on the other hand, give rise to the insight and understanding, the whole process comes to an end as a consequence. Does that make sense to anyone? Yeah? Anyone it doesn't make sense to? This is the general outline of the first three factors, how they work. I'm going to show you it from a couple of different angles as well, but do you want to say anything, Most Venerable? Yeah, so we're going to go faster. Yeah, okay, yeah, okay, a lot faster, okay. We have to go faster, okay. Yeah, we're in trouble, okay. Thank you, yeah, so, yeah. What time is it now?
Half past four,
okay. Good, so... Yeah? So let's have a look at this. I want to look at this also very quickly through the idea, the other two. But I'll finish this one before the break at least. So we're going to look at from two other points of view, and that is very briefly through the point of view of suffering and also through the idea of non-self. Yeah, I've talked about three characteristics, and just quickly see how this looks. So this is the illusion or delusion of that we don't see that suffering in the world is that we tend to see happiness where actually there is suffering. Yeah, this is the other kind of delusion. I talk about the three characteristics, impermanence, suffering, and non-self. And the second one, the suffering, is that we tend to see happiness in the world, happiness in things, where actually they are problematic. Yeah, this is kind of the second one of these. So what does this mean in practice? Yeah, So we think that happiness lies in the worldly things, yeah, like we just saw before. We think that we would be very happy when we get into that relationship, when we have that house and that kind of job, then our life will be together. Yeah, we'll be really, really happy. I used to think that when I was at university, I had all these plans for myself. I knew what kind of, I'm going to have this kind of girlfriend, I'm going to have this kind of job, I'm going to be really, really successful. Yeah. And I ended up like this instead. So it was a bit of a waste of time, right? All of that thing, you know, that kind of. Anyway, so you have this idea that happiness lies in worldly things. But the reality is that actually it is far less happy than you ever think it is. You carry on, you do these kind of things in your life, and then you come there, you're not really content. Yeah, the whispering in your ear is that when I have that relationship, when I have these things of the world, I will be happy, I will be content. That is what craving tells you, right? This will make me happy and content. Reality is, actually, it doesn't make you all, doesn't really make you happy. Content is always more after that, always more to be done. And part of the problem is that the lack of contentment that we have is really a psychological lack. There's a lack of completeness within. And that psychological lack cannot really be filled by external things. Or external things can be like a band-aid for a short period of time. And then that psychological problem or psychological dissatisfaction then returns very quickly. So if you want to feel satisfied within and content, you have to do something with your psychology. Yeah. So that's why the Buddhist teaching is really a psychology. It's about how to change your inner life, because that is how you find real satisfaction. Anyway, I better carry on, otherwise I'm going to get rightly told off by my venerable friend, which is it's good that we have can look after each other in this way. So, so then you chase after the worldly things, yeah, because you think they're happy. Sankharas comes out of the avidya, the ignorance about things. You start chasing. Then as you start chasing, just like before, you make good and bad karma. Yeah, if the chasing happens to commensurate with doing good, you do good. But if it doesn't, if you chase after things but you have to do bad to get them, you will do bad. So you create these various kind of bad, good karmas. Your consciousness is affected in the same way, just as we saw before. Then, after a while, we read the word of the Buddha, and the Buddha says, actually, there's less happiness in these things. And you think, yeah, Buddha, he was a wise person. I should listen to what the Buddha has to say. Then you start to remember the hollowness of the worldly things. The simile of the dream. So this is where I brought that in. The idea that the dream of the future is far more beautiful than the reality of the future. The idea that we will be satisfied when we get certain things. The idea of the perfect relationship, which everyone is seeking for. The idea of all of these things in the world, but actually the reality is very different. The simile of the dream is where the Buddha says, well, it's like you dream at night, and when you dream at night, you see all these beautiful things. Yeah, you see beautiful fields, beautiful hills, beautiful rivers, beautiful villages, and then when you wake up in the morning, there's nothing there. And that is like our image of the world within is very different from the reality without. And this is where we have to be very careful. So look at your mind when you fantasize about the future and ask yourself how realistic that future fantasy really is. And then you can add in a bit of and then what contemplation and then kind of start to kind of see things in a new way. It's fascinating how the Buddha has all these beautiful similes to kind of see through the kind of the veil and the delusion that is so powerful in us as human beings. This is another of my famous simile, the simile of the dog at the butcher shop. Yeah, this is the simile. This is a really powerful simile. I love this one. Does anyone know the simile? Yeah. Don't know it? Okay. So the simile, I have to say it fast, so I'm going to speak fast now. Simile of dog at the butcher shop is the simile of... Sorry, Vante, I'm being naughty. This is the simile of the dog which hangs out of the butcher shop, and sitting outside and looking with big eyes at the butcher and waiting for the butcher to chuck it a bone. Yeah, it actually says a skeleton, but a bone will do. And of course, the butcher is going to look after his meat. Yeah, the meat is worth something, going to sell it to the customers or whatever. So scrapes off all the meat, and all that is left on that bone is a bit of blood. Yeah. So the bloody bone, that's a bloody bone as far as the dog is concerned. So he chucks out the bloody bone to the dog, and then the dog chews that bone. Yeah, and there is no real satisfaction on that bone because there is no meat there. all there is the taste of blood, the taste of meat. Yeah, the dog is already hungry and weak. That's why it comes to the butcher shop. Doesn't get any satisfaction. There's no satisfaction there. All it gets is the taste. The craving becomes even stronger. The hunger is even more powerful than before. So what happens to the dog? Runs off to the next butcher shop. Next butcher, just as stingy as the previous one. Yeah, and it goes on and on from one butcher shop to the next one until it dies. Then when it dies, you get reborn.
That's a really sad story.
It's a very sad story.
Poor dog.
It's worse than you think, Bante. Wait, this is much worse than you think. This is only the beginning, yeah? This is really bad. And then it dies, yeah? And then when it dies, what happens? It gets reborn as a puppy. And when it gets reborn as a puppy, where does its mother take it? To the butcher shop, yeah? And then it goes on and on. And what is so interesting about this story is that this is how the Buddha says this is how the sensory world is like. Yeah, we are like this dog out of the butcher shop, always waiting to find satisfaction in something that can never actually give you satisfaction. Yeah, so we just chase on. We die. Next time we get reborn, we still try to find that perfect relationship. We still try to find the perfect career. Still try to find satisfaction in the sensory world, and we have done it already billions of times. We have never succeeded. And the time has come to learn from our failures and start to look at life in a new way. Yeah, this craving driving us on, the craving kind of leading nowhere. In fact, and this is one of those beautiful metaphors or similes of the Buddha, where he says that we are a slave to craving. Craving is in the driver's seat. We think that we are just fulfilling craving, so we are in charge. But actually, it is the other way around. Craving is in charge. And we say, yes, master, where should I run today? Where should my restlessness and agitation take me? And then we follow along, and craving is really in charge. Of course, this is what you start to see in meditation. Yeah, you see how the calm and the peace is far preferable. So this kind of simile, it starts to give you an idea of the suffering inherent in always chasing after things and never finding satisfaction. What is the alternative? The alternative is the spiritual path, finding happiness in kindness. Yeah, kindness is really what the spiritual path is around, is about. So when you find happiness in kindness, it's a very different kind of happiness. It is a happiness that is satisfactory in the present moment. It is a happiness that is not involved with craving. Yeah, it is actually involved. It gives an immediate sense of satisfaction. There's no craving there in the same way. And you're starting to fill in that itch inside, which is always driving you on to new things. Craving is starting to fade away. And this is the whole idea with the spiritual path, is that eventually, when you go very deep on the spiritual path, when you attain a state of samadhi or something like that, craving is completely gone. Yeah, ultimately, it's completely gone. That itch inside is no longer there. You've filled in that moat. Yeah, that moat of dissatisfaction, discontent has been filled in. And you feel fully satisfied for the first time in your life. And that is why a deep state of samadhi, it feels like you have found the meaning of life. Because there's nothing to drive you on anymore. If there's nothing to drive you on, if there's nowhere more to go, that is the definition of meaning. Yeah. So a state of samadhi is actually sufficient to feel a sense of deep meaning in life. And anyone who has had these kind of states will say that, yeah, that's it. This is the only thing I want in my life. That is the real meaning. That is the real purpose. You have to go beyond that, because the reason we have to go beyond that is because samadhi will fade away. But eventually, you through insight, etc., you make these things last. So let's... So unless we make samsara extra long by hanging around too long here, I better carry on. Again, you stop chasing after the worldly things. Yeah, you start moving on to the spiritual path. You make less bad karma, more good karma, and your mind and consciousness is affected by thinking in this way about the world. Yeah, you're moving in a different direction, doing new things. You're giving rise to more vidya and understanding here. Then you see things fully as suffering. Yeah, this is kind of the ultimate vidya. We're gradually becoming more wiser, gradually eliminating ignorance. Yeah, you stop chasing after worldly things entirely. You now only look within. Eventually, you see that the sense of self itself is suffering, yeah, because the sense of self is always fragile. It has to do with identity, it has to do with ego, it has to do with trying to satisfy yourself in the world outside. The sense of self is inherently problematic. And when you realize that, you stop chasing anything in the world. The two things that we tend to chase after are either the sensory world or things to do with the ego, with the sense of self. These are the two main cravings. Yeah, we talk about the tanha, the craving in the suttas. Two kinds of tanha. One is the kama tanha, which is the chasing after the sensory things of the world. And then there's the bhava tanha. The bhava tanha is a chasing for existence, which is a chasing after the sense of self or the ego and the identity and all of these kind of things. Because you see this, yeah, there's nothing to chase after. Sankharas don't serve any function anymore, just like before. You see them as suffering because they are restless and agitated, and then you find the happiness and stillness again, just like before, which is the opposite of sankharas. You stop making kama because of that, and eventually, no seeking for happiness in the future. The consciousness doesn't incline towards anything, and for that reason, it comes to a stop. Yeah, there's no more projection into the future by way of craving. Yeah. So, yeah, so this is the idea of suffering, using suffering as a contemplation to drive you on to the spiritual path and then gradually develop in the spiritual path in this way. I apologize. Yeah. So, let me quickly also go through the last one, if you don't mind, Bhante. I'll do that one as well. So this is the idea of self and non-self, yeah? And the problem with the idea of a sense of self, this is the atta versus anatta, yeah? This is the third of the three characteristics, is that we seem to be in control, yeah? The idea of a self, a very large part of that is the feeling of being an agent in our life, being the creator of our lives. So we feel like we have a degree of control of our lives. Yeah, this is the what this is about. Not only do we feel in control, but we like to exert control because that expresses the sense of self. We feel that our identity is getting indulged, yeah, or satisfied because we identify with these things. Just very briefly, our fantasies, they tend to end with our wishes being fulfilled. Yeah, we go out into the world and we make things happen. Yeah, we get our wishes fulfilled. Then we will and choose because we feel we can make these things happen. And then we chase after the worldly things again because we because of that will. You can see how these things work together here. Yeah, on the one hand, we see happiness in the world. Yeah, we think that there is happiness to be had in the world. On the other hand, we feel that we are in control of things. We have a sense of self that can deliver that happiness. So those two things together is very powerful. The feeling that we know where happiness can be found and that we have the agency to procure that happiness. Those two things together obviously makes us do things in the world. Yeah? It makes us try to get those things because we feel that's, you know, it can be done. Then we make good and bad karma again as a consequence of that, depending on whether things are... depending on the situation, yeah, and then consciousness is affected by that, yeah. If you make good karma, it's go up, bad karma, it tends to bring it down. After a while, you start to understand that you are in less control than you actually think. Yeah, you start to understand that actually the world goes according to its own cause and conditions. Yeah, things happen according to its own conditions. So very often, there's actually very little influence that we have over worldly phenomena, far less than we actually like to think. Yeah, and so you start to lose some of that interest in chasing after the things of the world because you understand that you are far less empowered than you actually are. Less chasing after worldly things, yeah? So, and then because you start chasing less after worldly things, you start to move on to the spiritual path instead. You look more at the process rather than the results. And the process is about living in the right way. You make less bad karma and more good karma as a consequence of that. You're moving away from the worldly life, moving more over to the spiritual path. Again, your mind and consciousness is affected by that. Now you're kind of raising your consciousness, making it brighter and lighter, etc., etc. Then you keep on reading the suttas, keeping on understanding how the Buddha taught. And then there comes a time, hopefully, yeah, when you actually see the idea of non-self altogether, and you understand that the world is even more out of control than you actually thought, and you have very little ability to control the outcome. Yeah. So this is kind of the way you see this fully, yeah, when you become a stream mentor or whatever. You stop chasing after worldly things because you know that the self cannot procure those things anyway in a way that is satisfactory. And then you see things again happening according to conditions. You stop chasing after anything because everything in the world is really happens according to conditions, not when you want it to happen, but when the conditions are right. Yeah. So you stop chasing after them. Instead, you kind of make the conditions. And the main condition for happiness in the world is stillness and peace. So you actually look for that in samadhi instead of looking at in activity and chasing after things. They serve no function. They're seen as suffering. Happiness and stillness, yeah, and then you stop making kamma because you enjoy the stillness instead. Last of all, you don't stop seeking for happiness in the future, and consciousness does not incline to anything because you understand that there is nothing in the world worth inclining towards, and then consciousness comes to a stop because there's no projection of our consciousness into the future. This is one way of thinking about these ideas, yeah, to try to understand what is actually going on here, why the connection between the avidya, our choices, and then how we feel about ourselves subjectively, and how these kind of things work together in this particular way. Yeah. So what do you think? Any thoughts on this? Do you want to say anything about this, or are you?
Maybe to see if there's any questions before we take a break.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah. Does anyone have any comments on this? Does it? Sorry. The number of this is actually not a sutta. This is just a bringing together. It's basically just dependent origination. But seen from different angles, it's not really one sutta. This is just, maybe it's my sutta, Brahmali number one. So I have to, that book hasn't come out yet, unfortunately. But have you got that on Sutta Central, Brahmali one?
We are unforgivably bereft.
I forgive you. Yeah, it's not unforgivable. I'm able to do it. Oh, yeah. Yes, please. Yeah.
In the context of self, sometimes it is defined as partner and other partner. Is it the same or is it
different? It's the same, it's just different languages. Atman is the Sanskrit word, so that's what you find usually in Sanskrit texts. Yeah. And you find it used in the Hindu tradition and the Brahmanical tradition, they always use the word Atman. Whereas the Pali, it's just a Pali, different spelling really, and they use the word atta. So, but the word is actually used in identical fashion in the two in all of those scriptures. And the main meaning of Atman, two main meanings. One is the sense of self as a permanent aspect of the person, and whereas the Brahmanical teaching said that there is such a thing, the Buddha said there is no such thing. But it's also used in the sense of oneself. Yeah, if you say, "Oh, you know, do it yourself," you could use the word "atta" in that kind of context as well. So it is used in a what is called a relative sense, but also in an absolute sense. Yeah, it's a very very common word in the suttas. So, yeah. Yeah.
They're all supporting these factors that you have there?
Kind of, yeah. It is, the reading is, you can see it is actually related to each of the factors, isn't it? Wow, we did a really good job with this. I'm surprised to see it was so good. But all of these things are, the thing is that the way I presented here is not exactly the same as the sutta. The idea is to you know, when you present things, you want to do it slightly differently to make a point out of things. But if you read the suttas carefully, you will see that the suttas, the message is actually the same. But you have to be able to kind of make that bridge between what is in the suttas and what I'm saying here. So this is kind of the idea. Yeah, one thing is to present the suttas as they are. Another way is to kind of to draw out the meaning of the suttas. I must admit, I agree a little bit with the Sujato that the ideal way of doing that is actually to take a sutta, read the sutta, and then draw out the meaning. Yeah. But sometimes it may also be, you know, okay to kind of put together meaning from many different places in a certain way. So, but it should all be in there if you look for it. Yeah.
We have reached the point where we are discussing consciousness. And it's important to remember that while we while we spend a good bit of time talking about scriptures and terminology and all of those kinds of things, none of these things mean anything except insofar as they point to some kind of reality that we experience. And if it was not talking about something real, then the Buddha's teachings would be just another fairy tale. The handsome prince meets a beautiful princess and they get married and then they go to Nibbana and then they're happy ever after. Yeah. Something like
that's
that.
That's a Buddhist fairy tale.
Yeah. Good. Please sit at the front. That's excellent. The center of experience is what the Buddha referred to as consciousness, or vijnana. And he used some striking phrases and analogies to talk about vijnana. Vijnanam bijam, consciousness is the seed. Consciousness is the Nagarasami, the lord of the city, who sits in the middle of the city at the crossroads. I believe that Indian philosophies are unique in their emphasis on the subject of experience. In Western philosophies, so far as I understand them, there's much more emphasis on the operations of the mind, like what we do, how we think. And it seems to me that even today, when people talk about the mind and consciousness, from a Western point of view, it seems that there's this kind of almost yawning and very kind of obvious gap where consciousness is just overlooked. It was not the Buddha who first pointed to this. There were sages, meditators, contemplatives, for a long time in India. We don't really know how long, but a long time. And they started looking within themselves and asking this fundamental question about who is this that knows? What is this that sees? And they wrote about this or spoke about it, sometimes in terms of paradox and wonder. One story, for example, talks about a student is seeking the answer from the teacher, and the teacher gets a mango seed, and the student is asking, where is myself? Where is the essence of who I am? And the teacher says, well, here's the mango, peels the mango, here's the seed, peels the husk off the mango seed. Is it this? And he keeps on going by taking apart the seed further and further until you get to the very kernel of the seed. And then he broke apart the kernel of the seed and said, do you see what's inside there? Then this is what yourself is. So you can see that there was this movement, this questioning, this wonder that characterized that culture of ancient India. Who am I? What am I doing here? And people began to notice this very subtle thing about experience. Have you ever thought about how odd it is that we see, but our eyes can't see themselves? I mean, you can look in a mirror, okay, but even then you're not quite seeing your eye, you're seeing a reflection of your eye. Yeah? Your ear can't hear itself. I mean, I guess if you go like that, you can hear it a bit, but generally speaking, our ears don't hear ourselves. What is it that's hearing? What is it that's seeing? And not only that, but what is it that somehow, why is it that all of these things make sense? How is it that the world sort of appears around us in a way that, like, if I hear somebody talking and I see their lips move, I can understand, oh, there's a person who's talking and the lips move, and it makes sense to me. How is it that you can be over there with your life, your experiences, your conditioning, and the way you see the world is from your point of view? Your world that you see is completely different from the world that I see. I mean, well, not completely different. I mean, if we're walking along a path, we can walk along the same path. Yeah? If we see an elephant running along the path towards us, we can both yell, run, and run away. And we can agree somehow that there is this external reality that we share, and yet we have our own individual and subjective impressions of that external reality. And what is that hidden thing that knows these things? And this is the question that caught the imagination, that inflamed the mind of the rishis and the sages and philosophers who came in the centuries before the Buddha. And in many different ways they sought an answer to this question, and they gave many different answers. And the answers they gave were often quite interesting. And during this course, we've referred from time to time to some of the different answers which they'll give. But none of those answers are really hugely satisfactory. Or not necessarily. No, sorry, let me retract that. None of those answers were completely satisfactory to the young Siddhartha when he went forth. Many people were satisfied by them, but not Siddhartha. He was a bit of a troublemaker. He was the kind of student who would ask annoying questions during the Dhamma talk. But Bhante, is that really so? And he wasn't satisfied. And even though many of these sages were very intelligent, very wise, many deep had contemplated deeply for a long time, and the Buddha expressed his respect for them and for their wisdom. And yet, this thing that he was looking for was so very subtle. The sages in the time before the Buddha, some of their teachings, and I'm sure it's only a small fraction of them, but some of their teachings are recorded in the texts that today we know of as the Upanishads. And one of the phrases, the recurring phrases found in the Upanishads, it talks about and this is particularly the teachings of a sage called Yajnavalkya. Yajnavalkya talks about the unseen seer, the unheard hearer, the unthought thinker, the unknown knower. Where in here, looking out, who is it that looks in? How can we see that which sees, that which sits at the center of all of our experience, and that which knows all of these things around us? This is what the Buddha called vijnana, consciousness. Now, when something is so subtle, so elusive, then there is a tendency of the human mind to attribute some kind of meaning and some kind of significance to it. Surely this must be important. Surely this must be in some way the core of who I am. Because it remains. The things that I know pass away. I see this, and then I see that. I hear this, and then I hear that. And yet all the time we have this sense of knowing which seems to persist, and yet we can never quite catch it. You see, it's always just out of the corner of our eye. How do we catch that vijnana out of the corner of our eye? And this is why this elusive and mysterious nature of vijnana is why so many great sages reached that conclusion and said, yes, this vijnana, this consciousness, this is yourself. This is, they would say more than that. They'd say more than it's your consciousness. This, that is the nature, the true nature of the universe. The cosmos itself is an emanation from vijnana, from consciousness. Everything that you've ever known is this vijnana. This is what some of those sages would say. And it's easy for us to read what the Buddha say and to say, oh yes, they're wrong. The Buddha said this is not self, therefore they're wrong. That's very easy to say. Anyone can read a book and say this is wrong. But to understand why it is that they thought like that, right? And to have an empathetic understanding. Because otherwise we can't understand why it matters. And it's interesting to me that I see, and I know Venerable Brahmani thinks the same thing, that it's interesting that in the modern Buddhist world, there's almost this chronic need to return to this kind of Upanishadic view of an eternal consciousness as a self, right? And you see, like everywhere you turn, it seems like different schools of Buddhism, different teachers, and they're talking about the original mind, and they're talking about all of these things. And it's like this need, this like propulsion to return to this kind of thing. And why? Why is that? Why is that such an evocative idea? Why is it such a persistent idea? The Buddha so many times. Vijnanasa nirodhena etetang upurujati. It's with the cessation of consciousness that all this comes to an end. That's what the Buddha was saying so many times. Vijnanasa nirodhena. So that mystery, that hides at the heart of our experience, to which all of our experience reports, which hears everything, knows everything, and yet which we can't see. Now, the path to seeing and understanding vijnana is a subtle one, and I won't talk about it too much, but one of the basic things is that we have to slow down. And we have to quiet down. And we have to bring the activity in our mind quieter and quieter and quieter. And then we can start to get glimpses, as it were, of this elusive vijnana, which is trying to hide from us, or it seems like it's trying to hide from us. One of the primary ways that we gain insight into how consciousness works is through the notion of the six kinds of consciousness, six sense consciousness. And that Vibhanga Sutta talks about the six kinds of consciousness, right? That's how it analyzes it, yeah. And so you have this kind of interesting thing that from here, most of the factors are then phrased in terms of the six things. Nama rupa is a bit different, but then most of them, like feeling and contact and so on, are phrased in terms of the six sense consciousness. So what that does is, in a Western idiom, we tend to think of the five senses, and the sixth sense is kind of woo-woo, hear dead people or something like that. And that's what the sixth sense. But from Buddha's point of view, the sixth sense is simply the mind. And the reason why the Buddha treats the sixth sense as the mind is because we can then understand by way of analogy with the earlier senses, the simpler senses. The mind is much more complex than the other ones. So if we start by trying to understand the mind, it's too much. How do you figure that out? So we'll start by looking at something simpler, which is sight. Chakku vijnana. Yeah? So sight is one of the most powerful of human senses and one of the most obvious. Right? We see things, but also the way in which sight works is one of the most sort of clearly defined. You see, we have our eyes in here that we see with. That's pretty straightforward, right? I mean, we can, you know, maybe it's like we have the lenses and rods and all of those details. We want to go into the biology a bit more, but basically the idea is you have an eye here which enables us to see, and the eye is connected to neurons and the brain and all of these kinds of stuff. And then there's an external stimuli. In Pali we call rupa, but literally on a physical level then that just means light. Light is a kind of electromagnetic energy. It's just an energy. It's just a pattern of energy. And it's a pattern of energy when it hits your eye, then it excites the neurons in your eye in a certain way, causes a certain stimulus interpreted by the brain, and the brain puts together the thing that you're seeing. The brain doesn't just see a mass of light, a brain sees people and walls and floors and all of those things. So this is the first kind of consciousness, and it can serve as an analogy for understanding all of the other kinds of consciousness, especially mind consciousness. The eye forms, and the eye consciousness arises on that. So you have some kind of stimuli, yeah, in here and out there. One of my little bugbears that I have is that in modern Buddhism, people always talk about the objects of the senses. And in the suttas, there's no word for object. The word aramana, which was used in later Buddhism for an object, is not used in that sense in the suttas. And it's an important difference. Again, I'm perhaps especially sensitive to this coming from Western philosophical background, because these things exist in relation to each other. When we call something an object, we are implying, it's implicit in that world, in that word, that it exists objectively. You see? Whereas that's not how it's presented in dependent origination. These things are presented in dependent origination as existing in relationship with each other. Now, in the case of the eye and forms, then it might be forgiven. You might think, well, the light waves exist whether I'm here or not. Okay? But in the case of the mind and the things that the mind thinks about, then clearly the things that you think about can't exist without the mind to think them. So this idea of the object, I think, is problematic, and these days I dispense entirely with using that word in discussing consciousness in Buddhism. So the eye and the forms in here and out there. And if we think about it, how your mind works, it's a little bit similar, isn't it? I mean, it's a bit similar even insofar as you can actually see things in your mind. Like you can imagine colours and shapes and people and things. Maybe not completely clearly, and people vary a lot in how clearly they can do that. But it almost feels like, just as your eye is in here and the things you see are out there, your mind has a kind of similar structure. You can almost feel like in here I have my mind, my consciousness, and it's aware of things which appear sort of outside it. The Buddha always talked about this difference, ajata bahidha. And I think the reason for that is because mind consciousness evolves together with and on top of these five sense consciousness. So in some ways, mind consciousness mirrors the structure of these sense consciousnesses, because that's how it evolved. So partly this is an analogy, but partly I think it's more than that as well. I think it's a biological heritage. So the ears work in a similar way. Ears in here, sounds out there. And stimulus. Nose is a little bit different, isn't it? Because when you smell something, you don't sort of smell it over there. You only smell something that's here. Each of the senses is subtly different. Body touch sensation also is very different in many ways, isn't it? Because touch sensation, we don't feel the outside there in the same way as we do with the eyes. Yeah? And touch sensation is also, we can't locate it as easily. It's diffused throughout our body. It's also much less, it's much less clear. Like you feel things on your skin all the time, but there's nothing there, right? I mean, you feel an itch. I mean, presumably there's something there, I don't know, that's causing the itch, but it's not like that sight, where it's much more clear about the separation between in here and out there. So again, this is why I think that the eye consciousness is at the beginning, as the analogy for how these other ones work. We look at the more simple one, the more straightforward one to start with, and then the other ones, each of them is a little bit different and varies a little bit in how it works. But we can still look at it in terms of that same overall structure. So then once we understand how these things work, then we begin to realize that that consciousness that we thought was there all along, in fact, is not. It's like our eye consciousness. Eye consciousness, it looks like it's there all along, but we know that it's not, right? We can go into a dark place, we can close our eyes or whatever, the eye consciousness is not there. Or it even happens that you simply don't pay attention and it's like the consciousness can be gone. Yeah? And I'm sure you've all been in that situation sometimes, maybe, you know, deep in meditation or even like reading a book or something like that, and some noise or something can happen and you just don't hear it. You just don't know it. And so our mind can become so immersed within its own reality and within its own experience that the senses don't appear. And this is called, what's that in the tajja... Samanahara, right? The tajja samanahara, yeah. So the attention that goes to the thing. So if we don't pay attention, there has to be an actual effort from the mind in order to process these things. Okay, so sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, consciousness. What that analogy with this, another thing that the analogy with the senses teaches us is that this consciousness is effortful. It's not something that just happens. It's something that we create. Yeah? Sankhara pachaya vijnana. If I want to see something, I have to open my eyes and turn towards it. If I want to hear something, I mean, we get so used to it. Right? We do it all the time that we kind of don't notice it. But if when you pay attention, you realize it actually... To operate the senses takes work. It actually takes a lot of work. And a lot of the processing power of our brain and our mind goes into making sense of all of this sense activity. Because the data that we get from all of our senses is incredibly complex and incredibly rich. And so our minds are constantly processing that into a form that's going to be useful for us. So once we can see that this sense experience works in this certain way with our five physical senses, we can gradually begin to see that it actually works in a similar way with our mental sense, with our mano-vijnana. Yeah? And you begin to realize that that mind consciousness also is effortful. It takes work to make it last, to make it work. It pays attention to things and then it doesn't. And you realize it actually isn't an eternal substratum of everything. It's a conditioned phenomenon which forms certain functions. Some functions we can begin to see and understand, some other things are still hidden from us. And then the deeper we go into meditation, the more clear the mind becomes, the more bright the mind becomes, and the more you can start to see this consciousness reveal itself little bit by little bit, little bit by little bit, little bit by little bit. And as the consciousness reveals itself, then you can begin to see underneath it and to see that that consciousness too is empty. It's impermanent. Okay. Let's go. Next line. What do we got? Okay, good. So we have a few terms here to talk about consciousness. Now, I've been talking about consciousness in terms of the six senses. But there are two ways, or probably a number of ways, but at least two ways that the suttas talk about consciousness. One in dependent origination. One is the six senses, and the other is in terms of the, what would you call it, the principle, the thing that... The process, the energy, the stream, whatever, as the thing that that goes on and gets reborn. So here we have the consciousness that roams and transmigrates. And here clearly is talking about the idea of rebirth. So again, this consciousness which transmigrates, I mean, technically is part of the manovijnana, the mental consciousness. It's not a different thing than the consciousness that you are experiencing right now. It's the same thing. And that is the crucial difference between the Buddhist theory of rebirth and the Brahmanical theory of rebirth. In the Brahmanical theory of rebirth, whatever it is that you're experiencing now, this passing sense consciousness, is not what gets reborn. What gets reborn is the permanent Atman. So there's like another principle or another entity which is proposed to explain rebirth. And the Buddhist theory of rebirth is that it's the same thing. What you're experiencing now is the same thing. The process of rebirth is the same thing. The thing that gives you continuity between one breath and another, between one day and another. The thing that makes you feel like the same person you were yesterday. That's the same thing that takes rebirth. Okay, next one. And a few different phrases for a similar kind of thing. The idea of a stream of consciousness, vijnana sota, established in this world and established in the next world. So just to be clear, this particular case, we can think of a stream of consciousness in a purely psychological sense. That's what James Joyce would think of it as, a stream of consciousness. But in the sutta, it explicitly is the stream of consciousness which is established in this world and established in the next world. Yes, onwards. Consciousness travels on, sangsarati, on-flowing consciousness, sangvatanika vijnana, the planes or stations of consciousness. We already introduced this concept earlier, the vijnanatiti. Interesting idea, the vijnanatiti is like a titi, is like a station, and it's almost like when you get reborn, that what happens is that your mind gets projected to a certain level. It might be the human realm, or it might be one of the other realms of existence. And once it's in that realm, it tends to have a certain stickiness. So consciousness changes all the time, but when we're in the human realm, it sort of tends to change around that kind of focal point. Like our minds might, go down a little bit and go, we maybe, become more animalistic, become angry and greedy and so on or whatever. Not that I shouldn't say that, because most animals are very cute. I shouldn't say that. But you know what I mean? And so our minds can go down, or we can raise them up through our spiritual practice and so on, but they tend to revolve around that point, which is the kind of the human realm, that's the vijnanatiti. And so we can get reborn in those different kind of levels. And so it doesn't mean that we're stuck in that level, but it just means that there's a tendency to sort of be around that kind of level or that station of consciousness. Okay. So this is a fun one. So this is, we mentioned a few times the Upanishads, and so this is a quote here from the Briharanika Upanishad. This is the earliest, oldest, and largest, and most interesting of the Upanishads, compiled from a variety of different teachings that existed probably a couple of hundred years before the Buddha, and is probably referred to directly referred to by name in at least one place in the suttas, in the Tevijja Sutta. At death, the top of the heart brightened. Okay. Through that brightened top, the self departs. Yeah. So notice how organic this is. The self, the atta, departs either through the eye or through the head or through any other part of the body. When it departs, the vital force follows. So the vital force, of course, is the prana, or the breath. When the vital force departs, all the organs follow. This is the indriya. It's probably mistranslation. It doesn't mean that your liver emerges from your head. It means your indriya, your sense faculties. Yeah. So the sense faculties will depart once the breath departs. Yeah. So the first thing that goes is the atta, or the soul. The second thing is the breath. And the third thing is the senses. So mostly that's an organic description of the process of death, except it introduces, of course, this idea of the Atman. Then the self has consciousness and goes to that body which is related to that consciousness. Okay, it is followed by knowledge, karma, and past experience. So you can see that this actually, in many ways, is very similar to the Buddhist point of view. Yeah, very similar. We're talking about knowledge, we're talking about karma and past experience. Same thing. When you get reborn in somewhere. Yeah, your karma is what drives you and directs you. It's your sankharas. You have your memories and your past experiences which shape you unconsciously or consciously. Some people can remember their past lives and remember those experiences, but for those of us, most people can't, but they're still shaped by them, just unconsciously. That's what makes us who we are. So all of that is basically the same as Buddhism, except it introduces this idea of the self, the Atman. You're going to object. Okay, so it introduces the notion of self. And so from a Buddhist point of view, what we would say is that the introducing the notion of self doesn't actually help to explain anything. We can simply take that out and it makes just as much sense. Yeah? I should add, though, just as a sort of, what do I say? This is a fairly unusual, it's fairly unusual for pre-Buddhist texts to talk about karma and so on in that same way. Like, this is unusually close to the Buddhist point of view. There's a number of different theories of rebirth and so on you find through the Upanishadic point of view. The reason I mention this is because people sometimes say that the Buddha just talked about rebirth because that was what everybody believed in India at the time. But that's simply not true. First of all, the Buddha wasn't an idiot who just believed things because people told him to. Okay, I mean, you and I are quite capable of critically assessing ideas that people say to us, and I'm sure the Buddha was also. So the idea that he just blindly repeated what everybody else said is kind of insulting, frankly. But more to the point that there were lots of different ideas about what happened when you died. Many of them talked about in the suttas, but also even in the Upanishads, there's many different theories and ideas about what happens to you after you die. And this is one which happens to be very close to what the Buddha taught. But there are others, which like the others that talk about you get reborn in the moon and then you come down in the dew and then you get reborn into the plants and then you come out through the plants and so on. So it's quite a different kind of idea. Yeah.
I mean, we know from the suttas, if we have to follow the suttas, we know from the suttas that Buddha was very critical and very inquiring, and this is kind of what he was known for. So the idea that he wouldn't inquire about this is just ridiculous, to be honest. And this is why he rejected the Alara Kalama and the Udakaran Puttas, because he was inquiring not only superficially, but actually in a very deep way into the nature of existence and into the nature of samadhi and all of these kind of things. And so,
I mean, he did it all the time.
Precisely, yeah.
Okay.
This is what kind of comes with the next one here, because that's the this one here.
All right, okay. So this is a sort of a very direct expression of that which is called citta or mind, mano or consciousness, that self is permanent and eternal. So this is one of the kind of wrong views which the Buddha talked about. Kind of difficult to find English translations for all of those, right? Especially citta and mano, psyche, One also might do, and I can't remember what I used, you might use intentionality for mano. But anyway, so these words, citta, mano, and vijnana, they're used in ways they're basically synonyms. And in a case like this, you can see that they can be used more or less interchangeably. But they also tend to be used in particular contexts. So they have contextual uses, even though they're basically synonyms. So think in English, for example, you have a word like car and vehicle, which are kind of, they're basically synonyms, but but they tend to be used in slightly different contexts or slightly different meanings anyway. So we might look at that, might come up a bit. I'm not sure if it comes up later. Anyway, let's go, continue.
Yeah, I'm not sure what's coming up next now, maybe not. Yes, I think we can stop there, because these are the suttas that I looked at before.
We looked at before,
We need to look at those again.
let's go.
That kind of things. Let's just move on to the next
thing here.
Did you have anything to add on vinyana? On
I'm very happy here. Yeah.
Okay, very good.
It sounds good to me here. Yeah.
Right.
Let's see what is.
So this is this has the whole. You have the whole Kachayana Gata Sutta in there.
Yeah, we can. We don't have to do it. I just left that from.
I mean, I would love to. I would love to, but.
But now comes this consciousness element form.
Let's do vinyana namarupa, because otherwise, if we get into the Kachayana Gata Sutta, then that could take us.
Yeah.
Okay. Before let's go on to vinyana namarupa, but before we do that, questions. You're asking what the Upanishads explain? Oh, what does it do? Oh my goodness, good question. Yes. Okay, so the question is, what are the Upanishads? What are they all about? Well, okay, so in the Brahmanical tradition, the roots of the Brahmanical tradition are what we call the three Vedas. In fact, the first of the three Vedas is the Rig Veda. Okay, and that's the main one. Actually, the other ones mostly are summaries and extracts from that. So the Rig Veda dates from maybe 800 years BC. But the content of it is older than that. Like it was compiled about 800 BC from content that existed older. The Rig Veda consists mostly of hymns and prayers to various gods and invocations of gods. Yeah. So and that was preserved as a sacred literature among the Brahmanical class. As time went on, the Vedas attracted explanations and commentary and so on. So the Vedas were accompanied by practices of rituals. Okay, so the first layer of commentary that we have on the Vedas were descriptions of how to do these rituals. So the Vedas themselves just have the hymns. So you can imagine you have like a liturgy book that might just, let's say for in Buddhism, you might have just a book. All it had was like Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato, and it had Buddhang Saranangacchami, and it told you the words that you were going to be reciting at that Buddhist event, but you don't know anything else about it. Okay, so then the next layer of commentary comes along and says, well, okay, this is what we do. We set up our shrine, we put our Buddha image on the shrine, everybody comes in, we bow down to the shrine, we recite the words like this, and we do that. So this is a layer of text called the Brahmanas, and they give the ritual descriptions for how to perform those rituals and sacrifices. But they're a lot more complicated. Like our rituals tend to be pretty simple, but they were, you know, had different people who had different roles, and they'd have to set up everything. Would be that like the ground plan had to be set up, and all of the order of things, and so it got very complicated. Anyway, then the next layer of literature, which we call the Upanishads, was much more reflective and contemplative, and that was asking much more about, well, what is this all about? Right? What do we mean when we're doing these things? And one of the characteristic phrases of the Upanishads is Ya evang Veda. Who knows this? Yeah? So what that means is that you can come along and recite your hymns and burn your offerings, yeah, but it doesn't really mean very much. But if you understand it, one who knows this, one who understands it properly, that's the person who will gain the benefit from this. So you can see that it's moving towards a much more contemplative and philosophical approach to things. And so the Upanishads have that kind of mix where they're partly talking about the rituals and so on, but then they go on to these different kinds of philosophies. And a lot of the Upanishads consist of dialogues between people about interpretations, where they will take up something and they will move towards a deeper interpretation of that thing that they thought they'd understood. And so you have these dialogues among different teachers and philosophers and so on, or teacher and student and so on. One of the main tendencies was to move towards this idea that even all of those externals of the religious practice don't really matter. Even if you don't recite the hymns, even if you don't have the place to do it, even if you don't do the ritual properly, even if you don't do all of those things, if you do it by faith, then that's just as good. You can just do it in your mind. It's much cheaper that way. So this is what the Upanishads were doing. And so it was really, and it's not so much a coherent philosophy. It's not like the Buddhist teachings where you have like one teacher and then everyone's one big collection of one teacher's teachings, mostly. Upanishads, all different kinds of people teaching all different kinds of things, and all kind of put together in a kind of semi-coherent way. Yeah.
I think the idea of the magician is that consciousness is very... Consciousness itself, by consciousness we mean awareness, yeah, the ability to know anything at all, the ability to be aware, is like a mysterious quality that you cannot really pin down. It doesn't exist on its own, it always exists in relation to other things. And because you cannot really pin it down, everything else can change except for the awareness. The awareness seems to be like this constant background there. And because everything in the world has to have some kind of bottom, it comes to a point where you can't really go deeper, you can't explain things in terms of other things. And that awareness is kind of mysterious. What is it? Where does it come from? How does it arise? According to the suttas, it is dependent on name and form. This is what we're going to talk about here, consciousness and name and form being mutually dependent on each other. Consciousness cannot exist independently. I should take this thing off. So it is. I think the Buddha uses it as a magician's trick because it's very hard to really kind of explain what it is or how, you know, what it is aware, but we, you know, it you cannot really pin it down any further beyond that. There are certain things that are kind of just are the base of reality. I think consciousness is one of those bases of reality. And you can explain a lot of things in terms of consciousness, but you cannot really explain consciousness in terms of other things. Consciousness is like the bottom thing. They talk about in philosophy, they talk about ontological primitives. That sounds pretty fancy, right? Ontological primitive is the kind of the base of the kind of the last thing in which everything else is explained in terms of. So consciousness, I think, is in Buddhism itself is what you might call perhaps it's not really ontological primitive because it doesn't exist quite in that sense, but it is a kind of at the foundation of everything, and that's why maybe it is called a magician's trick. But I don't know. Here you're the philosopher, Bandhasidharta. Do you have any kind of ideas?
Well, I mean, I think that the basic idea, I mean, the idea of a maya, and a magician's trick is it's an illusion. It's something that you see, and it's not actually there. Yeah. And it's, and again, this is one of the things I'm trying to convey is the strangeness of everything, the strangeness of our experience. We take it all for granted, and yet actually it's just this, it just fades, and all the things that we think of as so real turn out to be just, it's just not there. And you imagine all of these things in your head, and they just don't turn out to be not real. It's weird. We just live in this world that's so weird. Well, I do anyway. I don't know, maybe I do.
It is a magician's trick in the sense that it seems like a permanent thing.
Right, yeah. Something like that. Okay,
yeah.
So the question is whether, like, if you're in a relationship and a close connection with people, do you share, like, that consciousness or that nama-rupa or whatever? Are these shared? So generally in Buddhism, these are understood to be like a single continuity, right? So a single person. And the Pali word they usually use for this is a santana, as a continuity. And but what happens, of course, is that when, like, again, think of these things as patterns of energies. Yeah, patterns of energies. They're not solid. And when patterns of energies intermingle with other patterns of energies, they always influence each other, and they take on. They tend to resonate with each other. And even think about it, like, you know, I think about these things in terms of music as a guitar player. And in music we have an idea of a guitar string will resonate in sympathy with another guitar string. So if I play a E in the bass note of my guitar, then the B string will vibrate, because the B string is the fifth on the E, and so that will vibrate. Whereas if I finger, for example, a C, then that won't vibrate with the E, because it's not in the same harmonic sequence. So when those And there's that's not a mystical relationship. That's purely a physical relationship, right? In the case of sound, that things vibrate together with each other. But when you're with people, then you tend to vibe together with them. And we all know what that's like, right? That sometimes you meet somebody who's on the same wavelength, and you can immediately make a connection with them and talk with them and have things in common. And somebody else you meet and you don't have anything to talk about, and it gets very awkward very quickly. Yeah, so that kind of these vibrations together with the people that you're with. So this is why the Buddha said that if you want to get reborn with the same people in the future, then you have the same sila, the same behavior, the same faith, and you live together, and you do these things together, and then that will create those things where you can support each other. To evolve and to grow together, yeah. If you want to, yeah. Okay, how are we going? We're just wondering about whether we should embark on the next topic. Probably not now. It's now nearly 7:10. We're probably a bit late to go on to Nama Rupa now, right? I think so. Let's take some more questions. If there are any. If there's not, I'm sure you've got some jokes.
We can start by defining the terms. Maybe best way, I don't know, whatever. I don't really mind.
We've only got 10 minutes until then. We should start to wrap up, so yeah, it's not really enough.
Okay.
Yes, Jacqueline. I'm sure we've got some questions anyway. Where does the chitta fall into all of this? It's really good. It's really good being the senior monk. Yeah, I can just do that. You want me to do it, or do you want to do it? I'll do it.
Chitra.
No, I'm not. I'm not even going to go. I'm not. No, no. So chitta. So a little bit earlier, we had the slide that had the chitta, mano, and vijnana. Remember that? And we might even. No, don't worry about it. I was wondering whether we pull up that Sanskritic one with the mano and the chitta. No, don't worry about it. Okay, so we have chitta and mano and vijnana, which are three terms which are basically synonyms and basically used in the same way. However, they are also used in slightly different ways. Right? So the same, basically they're talking about the same thing, but they tend to be used with a slightly different emphasis and in a slightly different context. So chitta is a very general term. Okay? And it can be used in all kinds of ways. It means mind, it means thought, it can almost mean self in the sense that like somebody might berate their own chitta. Oh mind, you've led me astray, these kinds of things. Here I am sitting in my hut trying to meditate and mind, you're taking me back to all of the memories of the things that I used to think about. So chitta can have all of these different kinds of senses. Sometimes it can mean like almost emotions. Sometimes it can mean... So it's used as a sort of general language term. It's the most common general language term to talk about the mind and different aspects of the mind. But when it's used specifically in doctrinal contexts, okay, it tends to be used in the context of the Fourth Noble Truth. Okay, that is the path. Yeah, so we have words like chitta bhavana, the development of the mind, or chitta sampada, the accomplishment of mind. We have the chitta idibada, which is the basis for psychic power that consists of the mind. So in all of these cases, we find chitta. We don't find vijnana used in the case of the Fourth Noble Truth, nor do we find mano. So chitta in those cases comes close in meaning to samadhi. Yeah, we have like the adhicitta sikha, the training in the higher mind. Yeah, so in all of these kinds of cases, basically it's talking about the fact that we can develop our mind and we can enter into samadhi. So this is chitta. Mano is used in the sense of... Mano has a more active sense and it tends to be used in the context of karma. So you have mano... Sankara, manokama, which is the active portion of the mind. And so it tends to be used in the context of things like dependent origination and so on. Except, of course, there's a controversial thing where in dependent origination, chitta is actually used instead of mano in that definition, in the Vibhanga definition in Pali, which some people have made a big deal out of. In other versions, it actually does have mano there. And I think mano would certainly be the expected one there. But like I said, it's the same meaning. But it's just a tendency. It's not. If you try to make this a hard and fast distinction, you're going to be disappointed. So it's just a tendency.
You know, one of the things about these words like citta, mano, and vijnana, one of the things to remember is that the Buddha taught ordinary people, and they would have had kind of. Sometimes we make it into very philosophical and very. We try to make small distinctions between terms and kind of philosophize about it, but. When the Buddha gave a teaching to ordinary people, and they wouldn't have these things in writing, they would often get only one teaching, they would have to contemplate that. They would have to be fairly easy to understand, and not very philosophically complex or anything like that. So it's very easy to overread into the suttas and read more into them than it's actually there. And generally speaking, these terms, mano, citta, and vijnana, like you see in this particular thing on the screen there, here it is used as, they are used as synonyms, yeah? When it comes to that thing, which is called mind or sentience or consciousness, and the words here in Pali is chittang, mano, and vijnanang. Yeah? So they have a general sense of being, synonymous, but then there are certain contexts where they are used, and like Bhantasudhata was saying, they're used separately. Yeah? So it's important to kind of not read, to overinterpret the text. Yeah? Yeah. The question then is, well, what is the extent of the mind? Yeah, and I think this is one of the things that you see in the suttas, whereby you pull the mind out of the physical body, and the mind has the same shape, because it has a rupa form with it as well. So I think the mind is a kind of a whole body thing. That's why you feel. I mean, the natural limits of the mind are the same limits as the body. That's why you have feelings in the body, because the mind extends in this way.
Even a bit outside.
Even a little bit outside, okay. Yeah.
I mean,
the aura, you mean? Huh?
Well, yeah. I mean, you have this proprioception and stuff, and your ability to sort of sense people who are nearby you, and to avoid things when you're working. I always think it's kind of funny how that one of the things I think when you're driving cars is how the kind of the proprioception of the body extends to the car, and people will drive, and you're parking, and you'll pull 2 inches away from a wall. And if you're an experienced driver and you know your car and stuff, and you'd be quite confident that you can sort of pull past that, and I find it weird. I really noticed it once when we had a truck driver doing a delivery at Bodhnyana, at Santi, and he had to pull round the side of the house, and if you know Santi by the veranda, the monastic veranda, and if you go around there, there's not much room, and he's driving a truck. Like not a car, a truck, and he goes in there, and he's got to get into this thing, and he clipped the gutter a little bit coming in, and he was really down on himself. He said, "Oh, I'm supposed to be a professional. I shouldn't have hit that." I'm saying, "You're doing pretty well, actually," and he just had this kind of sense that somehow, almost like it's an extension of his feeling of his body, we're extending to the kind of the vehicle, and I don't know. It's just kind of weird. I think that the boundaries of our mind. Are actually a little bit more flexible than that. They can extend, or even another example might be a musician or something like that. The instrument becomes almost like an extension of their body. Or, just a thought, yeah.
I saw something really impressive. One of the monks at Bodhinala Monastery, he would reverse with a trailer.
Uh-huh.
And this was in the city. There was cars everywhere, right? And you had to reverse around a corner that was really tight and cars on both sides. And he just kind of boom, poof, back, and then went forward. That was pretty impressive, actually. That was kind of the trailer and the car was one with his consciousness.
One with his consciousness.
Well, maybe we're getting slightly on the side of it.
But I think that is an interesting point. I think that that our bodies and our minds are only approximately related.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're approaching the wrap up time. So for today, we have been over. We began with talking about sankhara. And the nature of sankhara as the creative or formative aspect of dependent origination, especially which conditions and drives that process of rebirth. And we talked about consciousness and the the meaning and the nature of consciousness and why it plays such a central role in dependent origination.